It's interesting because I was here in London in 1971 when I was 10 years old with my parents. And it was the very first time I'd ever left the country. Casablanca's playing. Let's go see it. And so we went to a great big movie theater, which is probably long gone now. I don't know which one. Couldn't tell you. And we saw Casablanca, which I'd never seen before. And I was immediately entranced by Bogart. Immediately. The fullness of what he's going through emotionally is there on the screen.
That was Kent Jones, film critic and programmer extraordinaire and director of the new documentary Hitchcock Truffaut. His is a rare form of passion for film as an art form, and we'll speak to him soon. Also ahead...
The truth is that writing a novel and directing a film, you can be as utterly alone in both.
Director Neil Jordan pops into Midori House to discuss his relationship with film. And a little later, we'll shine a spotlight on one of Australia's finest cinematic achievements, Muriel's Wedding.
It's often cited as one of three really key films, along with Strictly Ballroom and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of film on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Midori House in London, a city depicted on screen surely by no one better than Mr. Alfred Hitchcock. He's probably the world's most celebrated film director. His silhouette is as iconic as Charlie Chaplin's. His deep and utterly English vocals instantly recognisable. Alfred Hitchcock's impact on cinema itself and the legendary filmmakers he's inspired has become a form of modern folklore. And that influence was perhaps no better captured than back in 1962 when the French filmmaker François Truffaut interviewed Hitchcock over 8 days at his office at Universal Studios. The result of that was the book, titled simply Hitchcock Truffaut, published back in 1966, the tapes for which form the basis of a new documentary by the acclaimed film critic and programmer Kent Jones. I caught up with Kent over at London's exclusive hospital club in Covent Garden.
I was into movies from the time that I was a little kid. For a lot of people of my generation, the very first film that we saw was Mary Poppins. And then I was sparked by movies, very taken with them, and I wound up looking through books about movies. There were these big kind of picture books. Bruce Goldstein, who runs a cinema in New York called Film Forum, and I talk about this a lot, the days of cinephilia before home video, when you would have books and records and scripts as a way of relating to the film, recalling it, holding images from it in a kind of a talismanic way. And it's interesting because I was here in London in 1971 when I was 10 years old with my parents. And it was the very first time I'd ever left the country. And here we were. And one day they decided, hey, Casablanca's playing. Let's go see it. And we saw Casablanca, which I'd never seen before. And I was immediately entranced by Bogart.
The fundamental things apply. As time goes by.
Hitchcock, to me, is inexhaustible. If we were confronted with a situation, it's myself and Rachel Reichman, the editor, where we thought maybe we couldn't use a clip from one film, we could always turn to another one, because you know what? They're all good. Some of them are among the greatest works of art that we have. Some of them are very good, some of them are, you know, less good, but they're all good. He's engaged in every single film he ever made.
I'm never satisfied with the ordinary. I've tried to play the audience like an organ.
I was into the idea of making a movie based on audio. I was into the challenge of it. And I decided very early on that I wanted to make a movie with only directors, because it was a conversation between two directors about directing. So I wanted to keep it that way and just open it up to more directors, bringing it into the present. And I also decided that I wanted the force of it and the points that were made to come through by way of the form of it. I wanted the energy of it to be the only thing driving it, the way that everything was bound together. The surprises are in the tapes. First of all, the warmth between him and Truffaut, which is not always 100% apparent in the book, but I think it's there in the tapes. I think that also this very touching worry that he had about whether he had spent enough time experimenting with character and going deep into the question of character. This, I think, is kind of surprising. It's there in the book, but it's a relatively minor thread. But in the tapes, it comes up. Then I found this telegram that is at the end of the film where he's, you know, making this point about Cezanne Mondrian and, you know, should I have done this and that? And there's something very moving about that, about him maintaining this kind of doubt and worry. It came as a surprise to me to realize so many years later how close their deaths were. I never had put that together before.
Alfred Hitchcock, The Bird, stars Rod Taylor, Jessica Tandy, and Suzanne Plachet, and introduces Miss Tippi Hedren.
Even if you haven't watched Mad Men, you'll know that the society was more patriarchal than it is. And is it better the way it is now? Of course it is. But Hitchcock was from a world that was quite different from this one. And I guess that I can think of like a lot of other stories that are exactly the same. It's just that people tend to fixate on Hitchcock because of his weight. You know, it's this image of the fat man and the little woman, right? Then I think that in terms of like discovering something in his films, you know, about the sexuality in his movies, it's just like it's all there in the movies. It's, you know, few filmmakers who have ever been more upfront. So I think the films are usually more enlightened than what people supposedly have discovered in them. I think that it's a modern style of biography to get the goods on somebody, to look at the real truth behind the stories that they tell. Well, everybody tells stories, and, you know, everybody's done things that are less than admirable. So, first of all, I didn't go into The Enterprise with that kind of idea to begin with. This is not a film about, like, who's the real Alfred Hitchcock. This is a film about filmmaking, based on their conversations. Along the way, there are things that are glanced at that are of interest to those that are directed toward the prurient. But that's incidental to, you know, what I was interested in. And I think that it's probably time for biographers to start getting over that. All artists are human beings, and every time we find something that's not admirable about them, we should just say, okay, it's something that they did that was human.
I am interested in the audience. Obviously, they're going to sit there and say, show me. I know what's coming next. I have to say, do you?
Kent Jones there, director of the new documentary Hitchcock Truffaut, which hits theatres today. And to celebrate that release, MUBI are doing a special Alfred Hitchcock double bill right here in the UK. You can catch the 1936 film Secret Agent and, of course, the other film that he made in 1936, the wonderful Sabotage. Mention the 1992 film The Crying Game to anyone, and they'll likely raise a hand to their face in a desperate attempt to stop themselves from involuntarily ruining the almost mythical twist. The film's director, Neil Jordan, is one of today's most original and influential filmmakers, with titles such as 1996's Michael Collins, 1999's The End of the Affair, and 2005's Breakfast on Pluto, continuing to please film lovers. But he's also a passionate writer, something which he discussed at length with Monocle's Georgina Godwin. In this highlight, Georgina starts by asking whether being both a writer and a director can alter how his actors relate to his material.
When you're directing, do you think that your writerly side comes out as a director? I mean, particularly, say, if you're directing your own work, you must have a much more concrete idea of what that looks like than if you were working with someone else's material. I mean, perhaps it makes it more difficult for actors that you work with.
No, I don't think it does, because I think when you're directing, you have to look at the work as if some kind of not quite bright enough person wrote it. I mean, you have to look at it with a really critical eye, you know, whether it's your own original screenplay or whether it's based on somebody else's. You have to look at it with a critical perspective. But I mean, the truth is that writing a novel and directing a film, you can be as utterly alone in both, you know, both pursuits or both activities, you know. It's like, because, you know, you can be totally alone surrounded by 300 people.
I want to focus on The Drowned Detective in some detail. Before we get there, one of your most famous films, The Crying Game, had a very long genesis and many identities on the way.
Yeah, yeah. I had this idea of somebody who's responsible for the death of a black soldier in the north of Ireland, goes to London out of a sense of guilt, and abandons his kind of political and terrorist acquaintances, and out of a sense of guilt approaches his wife, but doesn't let the wife know who he is. Do you understand what I mean? So the idea of a relationship that grows out of some hidden responsibility, So I wrote it, and I'd write the first third of it, and the sections in the north of Ireland, and the killing, and the death, and the escape, and all that sort of stuff. And it would be totally intriguing. But every time I'd come to London, and I'd write him in the London that I knew, kind of tracking out where this woman lives. And she was always a hairdresser in some way. Maybe he sat down and got his hair cut by her and stuff like that. But it became ordinary, so it just became like a documentary realism kind of story. So I put it aside and forgot about it. And then I took it up again and I looked at it and I said, several years later, I said, okay, what if this woman was actually a man, And suddenly I went, okay, that's a entirely different story. It throws a different light on the first third of the relationship, the sense of guilt and the sense of unknowability within oneself and all that sort of stuff. So I began writing it and it became this totally other thing. But mainly it took it out of the area of prosaic everyday realism, and it became something different. And I managed to make it into a movie and, I think people's response to the movie were exactly the same as mine, For the first third, they thought they were in realistic territory and then suddenly, boom, they're thrown into another world of kind of gender, kind of realignment, surgery and stuff or whatever, And but they're thrown into another world of questioning and it makes them question the film, makes them question what they've seen before, makes them question the characters,
And, of course, Irish politics too.
Yes, politics and the whole idea of how does anybody define themselves,
The Irish political theme is something, of course, that continues in Michael Collins.
Yeah, well, I've made three movies in Ireland and three movies about political violence in some way. One was the first movie I made, Angel. The second was The Crying Game. The third was Michael Collins. I mean, Michael Collins was kind of at the granddaddy of all those Irish problems, wasn't it, really? And it was a commission originally. David Putnam, now Lord Putnam, commissioned me, asked me, what did I know about this guy, Michael Collins? And I said nothing. I began to read him, so he commissioned me to write a script. And it was another of those scripts that didn't get made. It takes a long time for movies to get made. And probably 10 or 14 years later, I was working with Warner Brothers, and, I asked them, would they look at this script they had in their vaults? And they said yes, So once they'd said yes, that was, that was, in a way, a strange way, the most difficult thing. It was an examination of, in bare, kind of dramatic terms of somebody who created the contemporary IRA, and was destroyed by it in the end, Created, tried to uncreate it, and it kind of led to a civil war and killed him. So it became a huge hit in Ireland. And it's being re-released now. It's the 100th anniversary of the 1916 Rising, and it's the 20th anniversary of when it was first shown in Dublin in Ireland. So they're re-releasing it in March in Ireland.
And of course, it was about a time, as you say, of huge political turbulence. But since it's been released, since the film was released, there have been many changes.
Yes, of course.
How do you see Ireland now?
It should be very proud of itself in that it's resolved the problems that seem to be plaguing the rest of the world, places like Syria and Libya and all that sort of stuff. And, it's kind of a poster boy for conflict revolution in certain parts, in certain areas. But it's the recession thing was terrible there. The people are very beaten down. They paid terribly for all those billionaire property developers and all that sort of stuff,
That was Georgina Godwin there in conversation with the director, Neil Jordan. And you can hear Neil discussing his writing career in further detail in this week's edition of Meet the Writers, premiering at 1500 hours Saturday here on Monocle 24. Still to come on The Cinema Show, actress Jeannie Drynan discusses her acclaimed performance in the 1994 classic Australian film Muriel's Wedding.
Take four young visionaries, add a pinch of independent flair and a healthy splash of avant-garde cinema. The result? Friends with Benefits, a taste-making selection of expertly curated films from some of today's most fascinating voices.
C'est dur pour Roxy. Deux papagayes dans l'armée, c'est déjà dur. Mais un seul, c'est pire.
From Benjamin Crotty's Fort Buchanan to Daniel Schmidt and Alexander Carver's The Unity of All Things, plus specially programmed short subjects. This collaboration with New York's Film Society of the Lincoln Center is not to be missed. Friends with Benefits, a carefully crafted selection of standout films. Now showing on Mubi.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. The film critic Tara Judah joins me now because, like me, Tara is also Australian and shares a unique insight into the film we're about to discuss. Now, as you might have noticed, the current issue of Monocle magazine is all about Australia, so we're going to spend the next couple of weeks looking at a couple of films that have come to define the modern face of the country's filmmaking talent. The local industry has perhaps never had a better year than in 1994, when two eternal classics hit cinema screens. There was, of course, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, following a group of drag performers in their drive across the outback. Another release that year gave rise to one of Australia's most admired actors, Toni Collette. That film was Muriel's Wedding.
We don't want you hanging around us anymore.
I didn't steal the dress, it was a mistake.
It's not the dress, it's you. We've told you 1,000 times how to do your hair, but you never listen. You never wear the right clothes. You're fat. You listen to 70s music. This is the 90s. We all listen to the Baby Animals.
And Nirvana.
You bring us down, Muriel.
You embarrass us.
I know I'm not normal, but I'm trying to change. I'm trying to become more like you, more of a...
It's too late.
I can change.
You'll still be you.
Muriel's Wedding is one of the films that's part of this kind of new Australian quirky cinema that really started burgeoning in the 1990s. So along with films, it's often cited as one of three really key films, along with Strictly Ballroom and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And the reason those three films get grouped together is not necessarily because they're the same filmmaker or because they're aesthetically similar, but because they all came out at a time when we were really discovering this kind of endearing side of like social problems in Australia. And so the characters are all the underdogs, the lead characters, they're all people who maybe struggle in society kind of getting by, whether that's to do with their gender, their sexuality, their social class, things like that. And so these films have social issues in them, but they do achieve that through entertainment. So the way that they kind of communicate those ideas is through comedy, is through being really self-deprecating. These are films where we really... like they're kind to their protagonists. So we get the sense that, you know, we're supposed to like these people, but there's also lots of really troubling stuff going on with their families, you know, with the way in which they're trying to achieve their dreams, what perhaps those dreams are. There's a lot of like complication, especially with Muriel. She's a young woman who her dream is to get married. And really all she wants is to prove to other people that she's worth something. She comes from a really small town called Pauper Spit, where the schoolgirls who were popular have bullied her all her life. She's still trying to be their friend. She's not accepted in the social circle. She's got lots of family problems between her mother and her father. So in terms of like that kind of stable familial function, but also in terms of her siblings, what their hopes and dreams are. They've been told repeatedly that they're worth nothing, that they're not going to achieve anything. They're from, you know, what would be kind of considered the kind of Aussie battler family. Mm. This is a stereotype in Australia of these people who've come from a lower socioeconomic background, and maybe someone has aspirations of achieving something outside of that kind of realm. And we see also in the film what we also hear of in Australia is tall poppy syndrome, where other people are really keen to pull you down if you want to try and achieve something else. And that might even be something as simple for Muriel as getting out of Pauper Spit, moving to Sydney and having a different kind of life. And this film really articulates that problem in Australia that a lot of people growing up in small towns feel. It's a really intense isolation because some of those more progressive values and some of those sort of alternative ways of living or just not adhering to a very particular type of what's pretty and what's right. You know, you have to move to big cities like Melbourne or Sydney to achieve that or to feel like even like you could have anonymity, I suppose. That's something else Muriel doesn't really get when she's living in Pauper Spit. So this story is about a young woman just trying to find herself, work out who she is, having, you know, she has a makeover as it were, but not in that kind of traditional sense. While she does have a physical physical makeover. It's much more about trying to make over her soul and trying to get to grips with what are the things that are really troubling and how can she actually get past those and not become part of that cycle as well, where she treats other people the way that she's been treated her whole life.
Now, we should mention this film, of course, is a comedy, and it's an absolutely tremendous comedy at that. It is so cutting, so dry, and so brilliant in the way it articulates its humour in such a deep way as well. You really come away from the film feeling as though you've just sort of developed along with the character of Muriel. You've really watched her go on this journey. But it's also a very dark film. And I always remember the great film critic in Australia, Margaret Pomerantz, describing this film as a very dark film. And when she saw it back in the mid-90s, she was uncertain as to how Australians would really receive the film. She didn't predict that it would go down so brilliantly the way that it did. What are your thoughts on that? Because it is a very dark film, but it's also a very enjoyable film, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, PJ Hogan's very careful to strike that balance between bringing in really heavy themes. There's, you know, themes like suicide, cancer, just personally, the kind of journey that the characters go on, the way that they behave to one another is really devastating. The politics at the time that's really woven into the story, and also the breakdown of the family unit. So, you know, this is really like crisis in cinema. But at the same time, that is always really carefully kind of teetering on the edge with acerbic comedy that's making a joke at some of those things, but also constantly reminding you, one, don't take everything too seriously. Like, you know, there are lighthearted moments to enjoy. There are joyous moments in life to really, you know, get something out of in this film. We do see those moments where Muriel is genuinely so happy. And the same for some of the other characters who have, you know, more difficult storylines. They have the same amount of joy as they do misery. So that it's very carefully balanced. But also not just not to take things too seriously, but also that, you know, we can laugh at ourselves. And I think this is what really makes this film quintessentially Australian of this period, is this was a time when Australians were really making a concerted effort, I think, in terms of their what they were producing in terms of art, but also because of politics and colonial history and all the rest of it, is really trying to make a point of, look, we can laugh at ourselves too. We don't always take everything seriously. We can be self-deprecating. We can appreciate that some things we do are ridiculous. And so we have these really overdrawn, amazing costumes and set designs. And I think that's really where this film kind of comes to life. When they're making fun of these horrible bully girls from school, is that, you know, they do that through ridiculous hairstyles, pink taffeta, you know, kind of like over-exaggerated facial expressions that Sophie Lee, who was a television host in Australia at the time and very well known, does just with aplomb that, you know, kind of really capture the hearts of the viewer. And so there is that comic relief constantly, and it does give it a lightness that I think balances out those really dark edges.
Now, as we were just hearing, Muriel's Wedding has long been considered an Australian classic, not least due to its excellent performances from stars Toni Collette and Rachel Griffiths. But what may be the film's most subtly brilliant portrayal is by the actress Jeannie Drynan. Her role as Muriel's mother, on the cusp of a mental breakdown, is a wonderfully moving contrast to the film's main thread. Monocle's Carlotta Ribello caught up with Jeannie Drynan on the line in Sydney.
Who is it? Is it Dad?
Muriel.
Muriel? Oh.
Mum wants to talk to you.
Muriel, are you all right? We didn't know what had happened to you. We thought you'd become a prostitute or a drug addict.
I'm in Sydney.
Dad's in Sydney for the inquiry. He'd love to see you. Where are you staying? He just wants to know you're all right.
Joan said he's moved out.
No. Well, yes, but only for his health. Dr. Farrell says he needs a holiday from us. I know he blames me for you taking the money, but I never thought you'd do a thing like that. Maybe it was a mistake at the bank, or I wrote the wrong figure on the check.
No, I took it.
Yes, maybe you did.
It's kind of interesting when you're shooting a film, because a lot of the time you're just doing your scenes and you're not entirely sure of what's going on in the other part of the film. But it was a fabulous locations and a wonderful crew. And in a way, I was playing the slightly darker role so that I wasn't part of all the fun and jollo when they're all singing. But I had the most wonderful time, and I'm living in America now. I spend my time between America, London, and Australia, and it was just wonderful to come home and be sort of filming on a beach with a great, talented group of people. I adored it, actually. But you often do not know whether the film is actually going to be the success that you hope it will be. I mean, I'm sure that we rather fancied that it would do well in Australia, but for it to have the resonance all over the world was actually quite lovely, and I love that. That's fantastic that Australian films can travel.
Now, the film, it is really clever in the way that it's a bit of a satire of Australian culture, that the great Australian dream being a complete nightmare for those who are outside the accepted norm. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's kind of interesting, you know. They were talking on the radio just the other day, and they were saying that one in four people living in Australia now were not born here. So in a kind of way, the sort of great Australian dream has kind of changed in a way. I mean, we have to hang on to what my childhood was, thinking of what Australia was. And we love the wide brown land, and we love our sports, and we love this. But we're kind of having to sort of turn our attention to something else, because they say Australia is a very multicultural country. And if you walk down the streets now in the middle of the city, you kind of don't see the laconic, tall Australian as much as you did before, because you often see someone quite handsome and glorious with almond brown eyes. It's interesting how we hold on to what is Australian and what we thought we were. And I think after the 2000 Olympics, we sort of changed in a way and became much more international.
Perhaps just finally, looking at Australian movies across the board, there's such an interesting variation in the themes. You can't fit Australian movies all into one box. What are some of your thoughts on the state of Australian film today?
Well, of course, the exciting thing is that we've just seen Mad Max Fury Road do so well. I think it's a bit like I was talking about before. We can do the Australian story, but we now have to turn our attentions out. Like Sapphires and The Last Taxi to Darwin, which is a great Australian film, they are telling the Australian story. But in a funny sort of way, we are now part of looking outward as much as inward. When I first started acting, my first film was in the 60s. We all were making historical films like Picnic at Hanging Rock or Picture Show Man, which was a film that I was in. And Australia was looking backwards in a way, but we're coming forward now, and we are part of a much wider audience than we would have been. And it's like Muriel's Wedding. I think we should make it for Australia, but I think we're hoping now that we can actually export our films, and I'm sure, and this is happening, and we can do this. We're very talented down here, you know. I'm so proud of everyone who is getting Oscars. We've got great filmmakers down here, so it's quite an exciting time to be a filmmaker in Australia.
That was Australian actress Jeannie Drinan there, speaking to Monocle's Carlotta Ribello. And on next week's show, we'll shine a spotlight on the 1975 classic Picnic at Hanging Rock. But that brings us to the end of this week's show. Thanks to my guests, Kent Jones, Neil Jordan, Tara Judah, and of course, Jeannie Drinan. Today's show was edited by Nina Norick and Toby Hammond. Listen again and catch up over at monocle.com, iTunes, or your podcatcher of choice. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thanks very much for listening.